Hello everybody, welcome back after lunch. Hope you enjoyed it. I'm Stephen Omdahl. I have together with me Bas Graf, who's going to do some nice demos later. But first I'm going to talk about system administration best practices for NAV 2013 R2. And well, the agenda for today is we're going to show you SCOM, System Center Operations Manager. And that's probably a tool you have seen in the keynote and maybe some of the other presentations, what was briefly shown. And it's a great tool for monitoring all kinds of different installations, network, different server products, including NAV. And then we're going to talk about manageability with PowerShell. Now you've seen that if you have been to the previous NAV sessions, both today and yesterday, there's been quite some PowerShell, and we're just continuing that track, because administration and manageability is definitely going to be with PowerShell. It is now, and it's going to be extended in the future for all, basically, Microsoft server products. And then I'm going to talk about something called scheduled monitoring. I'm not going to reveal what that is, but you'll see in the end. Okay, off to SCOM monitoring. Well, SCOM, that is the server product from Microsoft, part of the System Center pack that can basically monitor a NAV installation, NAV installation. So if you're running NAV 2013 or the hotfix or R2 now, then you're able to monitor all your installations and see what the status is and if everything is running healthy or we have some alerts, some critical stuff, and it's split into something called views, where, well, it's kind of obvious given the name, but you can kind of view what's the state of your system, the current state. And then we have something called discovery, where the system can be configured to communicate with a bunch of different machines, either grouped or standalone, and these machines will report back to the server, to the operations manager, with the current state of everything it has to discover and monitor out there. And it's collecting data. So all the different machines that has been enlisted to SCOM will report back to the main overview, to the main operations manager. So you can always see the current state in the views. You can see a bunch of different data that we have decided to collect, but you can also extend it so you can collect your own data and measurement points and what have we. And then we have created some built-in monitors that is going to basically monitor a running NAV installation. So it can report back, say, oh, suddenly I lost a connection to SQL, or oh, there's a lot of errors in the event log, or something is wrong with latency to SQL. There's some performance monitors or measurements that are not as expected, and all that. So it's going to generate some alerts, some warnings, depending on the monitor. And then I'm going to show what's new, because we actually already had a SCOM pack. It's called SCOM for System Center Operations Manager, and then this pack, it's basically just an XML file defining how we want the NAV server to be monitored. And that's the SCOM pack, and we actually had one for 2013 as well. So I'm also going to briefly talk about the new stuff we have put into the R2 release. And going to find a demo server here. If I want to install it, then I can start up here with the initial dashboard after you kind of install Operations Manager. Then you can import a management pack. And the easiest way to do that is basically to go to a catalog, and then it's browsing the online catalog that hosts all the management packs for all Microsoft servers. And if I search here, takes a little while. It says there's Microsoft Corporation. I will go down to Dynamics. Then we have the Dynamics products. I will pick 2013 and I will choose add. And then it's giving me or returning the list of available management packs for Dynamics NAV 2013. And you can see it's a little version number. And the difference here is that the one with the higher version number, it supports the Operations Manager 2012, whereas the one with the lower version number here supports Operations Manager 2007 R2. So it depends on what version of Operations Manager you're running, then you need to take the right pack. And we don't have the pack up for R2 yet, but it'll be there very, very shortly. It is done, but it just needs to be released in the final state, and documentation needs to be packed, and so it'll probably be then, let's say, a month or so. I have already installed it, so I won't do it again. And what I get here is a folder named Microsoft Dynamics NAV 2013, and it covers both the 2013 version and the R2 version, and of course all the hotfix versions. And if I go in here, then I have a list of computers that I'm monitoring. So right now I have 3 computers. They look healthy. Everything is fine. It's very simple. If I were the administrator, I would say, okay, this is great. I can just grab another cup of coffee and sit and stare at the screen. Or maybe if I'm also monitoring the network and the Windows client, then I can move to some of these monitoring packs. But what I would most likely do is to go up to the active alerts up here. And that one will kind of collect the entire state for all the monitoring packs, for all the different machines. Everything is kind of aggregated up to the active alerts window. And I can basically just have this window open. And if something happens to NAV or something else, well, it'll show up instantly. Say, there's something wrong here. This is a warning. I don't have to respond to it right now. We'll get back to the different warnings and alerts later. Right now, I'll just show the artifacts of NAV. We can see, oh, the NAV servers are running fine. Have some server instances. Oh, there's a server instance here that is showing a little warning. Again, I won't dig into it now, but you can see it's constantly monitoring, and suddenly some state changes, and it can change back if it detects that, oh, it was just a little glitch, some temporary stuff. So if I'm monitoring it constantly, then it might turn out that there's some flags or some notifications being sent, but often these are auto-repaired. So it's very important to actually get to know Operations Manager and maybe not react instantly, but maybe dig down to see what the alert is about. There's a lot of information about and knowledge about all of these alerts being generated. So you can, you kind of get a feeling with what is going on and what the state is. But right now, everything is healthy. And we are taking some measurements. For instance, I can look at the events for one of the server instances, and it's collecting all the informations, the warnings. I can see, oh, there's something about service principal names not being added, and there was a little error here. I can go back in time to see, oh, there was, what's wrong here, something with a certificate not being valid, and there's some different information. Everything is collected, and you can always go back in time and see how the event log was on a given machine or a given server instance. We can also take a little performance view, and you can basically see all the NAV performance counters. We have quite a few. I think there's 16 or 18 or something. That is coming with the product. So when you install NAV server, it registers all these performance counters, and you can see what the state was for an instance for open connections over time. Oh, there's been two connections, still is. And mounted tenants, there's one mounted tenant, that's the default one. And that's something new for the R2 pack. For 2013, we only had the heartbeat performance counter. And see if I can find that one. That's right here. Error is server operation time. So if I click that one, then it's very close to zero because the database is running on the same machine as the server instance here. In my case, of course, I would expect something very close to 0 milliseconds. But if you're running in system distributed system where you have the database server on another machine, then you would expect that there could be something with the network and it'll show up instantly. We have some monitors for some of these perf counters, but you can easily go in and configure your own if you want to monitor, for instance, open connections. If it reads a maximum of a threshold value, say 100, then you should be alerted, something like that. It's very configurable. And then if I go to tenants, then we can also see all the tenants on all these server instances. And you can see all the different properties. If I just pick a random tenant here named Kronos, then I can see it's actually running. It's having this full path running on that machine, hosted by that server instance, has the name of Kronos. And some other information, some other detail that are very nice to have here. Same for server instances. It's basically the primary configuration values. If I take the first one up here, I can scroll down and see the credentials type means how do the client authenticate against the server. Well, it's with this type named NAF user password. Where the user is prompted for credentials, you need to type in username, password, and log in. As if you're running in a Windows domain, it's normally Windows you use, and everything is just happening behind the scene. But this installation, this operations manager, and all my clients, they are running on Azure and has been deployed to Azure. So I can log in externally. I can log in with a client. On the web client. And you can see the different ports, you can see the version number, and if the different services, client, OData, SOAP are enabled, and if it's running in multi-tenancy mode. So this one is false, means that it's run single tenant. Whereas if I take one of the other ones, yeah, I can actually scroll over here and see that I have two of the server instances that are running multi-tenancy. And I take one of those. You won't be able to kind of see the difference because these are just common config settings. These are just common values. So the only thing that can kind of determine that this is a multi-tenant server is this property, and then it shows up in the tenant view. And then I have web server instances. Well, I have three machines, and they have all been deployed with a web server instance. And that's where the web client is located. So if you have a web client, you log into the web client. This is the web server instance properties. So you're able to see the where the configuration is, where the public URL is, and again, the fully qualified pass. So machine name, where it's located, and HTTPS address, and yeah, what port it's using, and again, credential type. And then we have websites. Websites, that's the help server. It's a NAF artifact. It's not a web server instance, it's a website. And if you're running 2013, then we didn't have this concept of web server instances. It's kind of a new one. We were deploying a website. When you install the product, the full DVD, and you want to install the web client, then it was a website, and these websites that has NAF capabilities or some NAF artifacts, they are discovered here with websites. Whereas a new one is more like a web application, and it'll show up here in web server instances. And again, we have some different measurements for these. I can go into one of these monitors we have. I'll just double click one of them. Server instance. I know this one was unhealthy just a little while ago. And I can see the different states that this machine has had since installation time, basically. And I can go back in time and see, oh, there has been some instabilities here. It's quite shaky. And maybe there's some information, not much here in this case. Well, that's very little, not very informative. But you can see the different monitors that we are having on a server instance. For instance, we're having a performance monitor where it's monitoring the heartbeat time, and there's a nice description over here saying that, well, it's doing a round trip to the database every 30 seconds, and then it's measuring. Well, it's actually going to the database from the NAV server instance and writing to one of the tables, going back and measuring the time. And this monitor is about, well, if it takes more than a given threshold value, then it generates an error. Then there's something wrong here. And we have something with certificates, a configuration monitor, certificate close to expiration, and certificate has expired. So it's actually generating warnings whenever there's a certificate that a server needs that is nearing its expiration date. And that default value that we have used is 30 days. So whenever you're 30 days from a certificate expiration, then it generates a warning. And it does that every day. And you as the operations manager are alerted, and you can react to it, and once you have renewed your certificate, then it'll turn green again, it'll turn healthy. And once it has expired, like this one, then it'll turn critical, the state will turn critical, the server can no longer be used, it cannot accept incoming requests, so of course you'll have to do something. And then we have something, service running. Well, is it available or not? Is it actually running? We have a SQL monitor where we are monitoring the SQL server states. Also, the server generates events of a given type, and if its type is recognized as a SQL fatal error, then we're also capturing that one. So there's quite a bit of monitoring going on, but as long as the system looks green, then everything is good, and the administrator can take another break and a little cup of coffee. And that's kind of the overall view of Operations Manager. I will dig more into details later, and I will give the word to Bas.
Thank you, Stefan. So Stefan showed you all the ways that we can monitor what's happening in the data center. I will give a small demo in which I basically generate a lot of events in this data center for him to monitor. This demo is about, let's say, a partner that is hosting an NAV service using all the tools that you've maybe seen in the other sessions to set up his service on Azure and then to deploy NAV on it. And then he's running the service and he's offering it to his customers. And now after the first week, 500 customers signed up. So now what? I want to show you how you can use the tools that we built in PowerShell to create a simple script that allow you to easily deploy and quickly deploy new tenants on your installation for your new customers that have signed up. I will first show you on this laptop how to do it, and then once we have a small little script developed, we'll execute that script in the data center to sign up a set of customers. So let me switch first to the administrative console, which is also built on top of our PowerShell commandlets, but gives you a more limited set of capabilities for managing the servers that you have. So in the main view, you just see the NFV instances that are running on this machine. And looking at this instance, the instance one that we will be using here, just give it a minute. So this particular instance is configured as a multi-tenant service, as you can see here, and which is means that now you also get this node here that lists the tenants that are running in this service. From here, I can also mount a new tenant. So I get this form where I can add a new tenant. I need a database, so let's restore the database. In this demo, I will be using a database backup basically as a template for creating new tenants. Using the demonstration database, I removed all the application tables, and then the tenant database that remains, I created a backup of that, and I will use it each time I will create a new tenant database in this demo. So let's actually create it. And it's in this folder, backup. This is my tenant. So I'm using this more or less like a template. Okay. And now it shows up here. And now I can go back to this screen and actually use that database to mount a new tenant. There's a couple of other fields here that we will discuss later. Let's just do this for now. So now it shows up here, and I have a new tenant, and I could connect to it via the web client. But then you're already running into the limitations of this console, because I don't have a user yet to log in there. So now I will switch to our PowerShell tool set. Don't forget to run this as an administrator. Here we are. And I can do the same. So what I did just now, restoring a database, we also have a commandlet to do that. Give it a path to the backup. Then let's give the tenant the original name of T1. And we also need to specify where we want the data files to live. And that will be somewhere here. Oops. Oh, sorry. So this is creating, restoring the database into a tenant database T1, just as I did from the SQL Management Studio. And now I can use, as I did in the console, but now I'm using the commandlet to mount that tenant on instance 01, which is the service name of my NFV service. And I give it the tenant name and the database name. And since in the template, the tenant name was tenant, and now I'm using a different tenant name, being T1, I have to be explicit that I want to override that name. This is just a safeguard if you would accidentally mount a tenant database on another tenant. So now I have a tenant. So now we're kind of at the same point where we were before, having a database and a tenant mounted on it. I can just show you that it's created here now also. See? And I could connect to it, to the web client. So now this is the login screen, and same problem as before. We create a user, and we can do that from this command line using the new nav server user commandlet. Give it the instance name, username, let's say Chris, and password. This is a little bit tricky because you need to, you cannot supply an ordinary string here. You have to supply an encrypted string, and you can obtain one by using this commandlet. Convert to a secure string from plain text, and then ignore all the warnings. So now you can see that we're running in multi-tenant mode because I forgot to specify a tenant, and the user is specific for a tenant, so I should at least also specify for which tenant we want to create a user, which is T1 in this case. Done. The final step is to assign the proper permissions to this user so that it can do his work. And for that, we create a new nav server user permission set. Again, instance name, instance 01. Don't forget to specify the tenant, the username, and the permission set that you want to assign. To make it easy, I will just be assigning the super permission set. So now I can log in on this tenant that I opened here. I hope. It's called server, apparently. It goes. Okay. So now we have provisioned for one new customer and a user in that customer. But I wouldn't like to do this 500 times more for my other customers that signed up. So now I will be using the commands that I issued individually now and try to build a little script from this. But before that, we will do a small intermezzo to see how the PowerShell pipeline is working, and how you can transfer results from one command into the next command. So as an example, take this commandlet, which will give you the command history. And with PowerShell, this is not an ordinary string, but actually this is an array of objects, of rows, saying the ID of the command and the actual command line that was used. And now you can loop over this by issuing a command like this. And for instance, for each row that I get back from this history, I can return this. Well, this is not very interesting, but it does get more interesting when you start using the loop variable. With dollar underscore, you can actually access the loop variable. And if you do like this, you just get back what was outputted by the previous command. But since everything is an object in PowerShell, I can also access the individual properties. So I could just list out the commands that I issued. So, and we will be using this later, building this script and executing it on a remote machine. But for now, I can use this actually to move my command history to the clipboard and start my scripting environment. So now I just pasted. Maybe I should make it a little bit bigger. So these were the commands that I just issued, and not all of them were successful. So let me just filter this a little bit. I don't know. Is this readable in the back? Kind of. Okay. Then we just keep it like this. So let me just keep the commands that we really need. So this went wrong. Here I forgot the tenant name, and we don't need this. So now I have my little script, but of course when I would execute this, it would create the same tenant with the same user, which is not what we want. So we can really quickly replace the names that I used here, T1 for the tenant with a parameter, and do the same for the user. So now we have a little script. I just have to say here that this script takes two parameters, tenant and user. Let's save this with the name provision nav customer. So now I can, here's my mouse. I can execute this script using these parameters, and then now I can start provisioning customers a bit more quickly. And what's very nice about PowerShell, it will give you automatic completion of these parameters so that you know what you have to fill out here. So let's do T2 and for user Stan. So now it's done. So this was my second customer. And I can just as well as the other one connect to it. And now I use the query string where I specify the tenant for T2. Oops. Oh, yes. Thank you. So, and I can log in with Stan, yes. So, this is my second customer, but all this is still local on this box, and we have this machine running in Azure that I want to use. So, now we will have a quick intro to PowerShell remoting and how you can, from this box, can remote into the machine that is running in your data center and then issue commands to manage your nav installation. So for that, you have this enter ps session commandlet, and you give it a computer name, nav.ms. I will show you that this is the domain name that I'm using to connect to this machine in Azure. And then the credential is the administrator on that machine. And then this parameter, the configuration, what I set up front to make sure that all the necessary modules are loaded in that session. So it asked me to authenticate. So this might take a while. In the meantime, I will show you how I've set it up. So this is the machine as it is running in Azure. And so this is the IP address down here. And then I also have, let me just see here. This is my, my registrar where I registered this domain, nav.ms, and I just pointed it to the IP of the machine running in Azure. So now I can connect to that Azure machine by using the domain name nav.ms, as I did here when I connected to the PowerShell there. So it's there now. So you can see that we're now running on that machine. So I can execute some commandlet here. So get nav server instance to see what's running here. So we have one instance with the same name running there in the cloud as we had on this box. And I can, for instance, now query for the tenants that has been mounted there. Get nav tenant instance 01. So you already see that there's a whole bunch of tenants. So let's clean this up a little bit. So another demonstration of the PowerShell pipeline, I can filter the output of this command by the tenant ID being not equal to default. I want to remove all the tenants except for the default one. And then the output, I can pipe that one into the dismount commandlet. and I will suppress any confirmation dialogues. So now all these other tenants are gone. So now we have just one tenant left here. Okay, so this is all fine. I mean, I'm now in this interactive session and it still doesn't tell me how I could execute the script on the right in that session. So let's go back to the local machine. I exit this session. I'm not quite sure why this PowerShell remoting is slow in this situation. It might be because all the authentication is done by certificates. Okay, so I'm back. So another thing you can do with remote sessions is that you can assign them to a variable to and have a reference to that session, and then using that reference to execute scripts remotely. So instead of enter PS session, I can say new PS session. That will not enter an interactive session, but would just create it. And then I can assign it to a variable like this. It gives me the same credential dialog. So while it's doing that, I will also add some logging here. So log message. And it would just output that message in some nice color. Green. And it would stamp it with a date in a sortable format. Like this. So now I can easily, excuse me, add something like log provisioning customer with the name tenant, which is my parameter, and then with user, and then add a few more here, log tenant database created, and then tenants mounted. One more user created, and then we just say done. Okay, this is a lot nicer already. Okay, so what happened here? It's finished now creating a session to that nav.ms machine running in Azure. We can see what it looks like. So it's just a session and it's opened and I can use it now. So now I'd like to execute the script on the right. And execute it against that machine so that I can provision a new customer up there in the cloud. For that, there's a commandlet that we can use. It's called the invoke command. And you can invoke commands anywhere you want on the local machine, but you can also give it a session that we just created. And then say, I want to execute a certain script. That's our provision nav customer script. And give it the arguments. So tenant 1, 2, 3, and user 10, go. So that it's now using the session, uploading the script to that machine, and then executing the commands from the script there to create the tenant and the user in the cloud. And then when it's done, let's wait a bit more, and we get a nice logging. Done. So now we should be able to connect to this tenant. Let's try it. So we're going to https nav.ms instance 01 web client, and then the query string tenant equals tenant 123. So we get a warning about the certificate. We will get back to that later. Now I just continue, and okay, so now I can sign in here. Done. So that now I've, you know, first time I now provisioned a new customer on my Azure, of my NAV servers running in Azure. And I have a script, so I could now kind of, you know, multiply that and do it quickly, add more customers. Then the last bit of this is to looking at this URL where you need to add this query string, which this is not so user-friendly. And perhaps, or probably, my customers would like to use like a nice URL. They might have a domain name of themselves, or the hoster in this case want to offer something like tenant123.nav.ms. And we can also configure that, and it's a three-step process. The first thing that is required here is that you set up your DNS so such that, in this case, subdomains point to the main domain. So this is this line here in my configuration, saying that any subdomain indicated by the star is just forwarded to the root domain, nav.ms. So if I connect to tenant.nav.ms, it's forwarded to the root domain, which then, using the DNS, gets to my Azure instance running there. And then the final trick is that the NAV server needs to know if somebody requests accessing a tenant with this particular domain name, that it needs to know to which tenant it should map that. And for that, we have an additional parameter that we can use for the mount nav tenant, where you can specify an alternate ID. So in this case, saying that we want to provision subdomains, tenant.nav.ms, it would look something like this, tenant.nav.ms. And now the server knows that if somebody requests that particular domain, that it maps to the tenant that was mounted here with this name. So in this example, it's kind of the same name, but it can be different. So let's try that. And I will also, I don't like this output, so let's. So the output, this part, this is outputted by the, when we create a database, that is this line here. And I will just redirect that to make sure that nothing is outputted there. So let's try it. So this is the same command as before, using the session to the nav.ms machine. And let's try another tenant, another user. I also have a picture of this. I was pretty sure I couldn't explain this clearly. I'm not sure if this helps, but when you go, so that's the customer that signs up with you as a hoster, and that customer wants to use its own domain when accessing this NAV service. So then you configure in the DNS that domain is forwarded to the hoster's IP. That's step one. And then the browser contacts that IP, the hoster machine running in Azure, and in the request, the original URL that was used, customer.com in this case, is provided. And then IIS, the web server, has a URL rewrite rule that knows that if a tenant was not specified in the query string, I would just paste the domain name that was used in there. And then via the alternate ID of the NAV server, it knows that it, in this case, you know, should end up with tenant T1. Let's go back. Is this done? Yeah. So now we have tenant 456. And for this one, we can now use the subdomain name. So https t456.nav.ms. .ms. And that's already a lot nicer. Let's log in. Oops, wrong username. Chris, yeah. Okay, so now I have another tenant, but now deployed with a nice URL using the specific domain for that particular tenant. Final step is to complete this story. So now I have this list of all my customers that signed up this week, and now I need to provision this a new web client instance and everything for this list of customers. Let's add one more. So this is just a file with comma separated values, and we have the header here. So we have tenant and users, and then a bunch of. I try to find all the names that we use internally in Microsoft for temporary fake companies. So using this file, the PowerShell is very capable of dealing with these comma separated value text files. There is this import CSV, and it will give you, it will read this file and then has a return in a table with tenant and user rows. And then using the for each object construct I showed earlier, you can iterate over this and then call the invoke command of the provisioning script on this side to provision for each of these new tenants, new customers. So let's try that. I also want to show you, if you think that the syntax for PowerShell is verbose, and it is because we have quite long commandlet names, but most of them are aliased, so you can also have a very, very concise syntax. So let me try that. So the alias for import CSV is IPCSV, import CSV customer, which gives me this table that you see above. And then there's an alias for each, which is just percent. So now I'm entering this loop. And now I want to issue my invoke command to invoke this script on the remote server. Invoke command, you can do that with ICM. Give it the session to my remote machine. Minus F, file path. I give it the file path of the script. And finally, AR for argument list. I give it the arguments that tell it which customer, which tenant, and which user to provide. And for this, I need to use the loop variable. So that's dollar underscore. And now I can just access tenant, because that was in the heading of this text file. And I can access user. So this is a pretty concise command line. And this will actually provision all these customers. This list of customers, not really 500, but still six. So it's taking a long time, so I'm glad we didn't do 500. So the first one is done, so that was Cronus. So now I can go here and go to https://cronus.nav.ms. So the username there was Stan. So the final thing, just to show that these are really different and new instances for this customer, so I would just post a sales order on this side. So now I should have 19 instead of 20. Yes, here, 19. So is it done? Yes, so the one I added in the end, Cinemax, it's also created. So let's go to Cinemax. User was Stan. Yes, so this one still has 20. So these are really all new, different, separate instances for this list of six customers that signed up this week. With that, I think I will hand it back to Stefan. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can show us some monitoring that happened in the meantime.
Hopefully, Kane. Yeah, thank you. Okay, now I'm going to talk about this concept called scheduled monitoring. Well, currently we have passive monitoring where we are going in and we are kind of monitoring the system or the systems you have in AV systems, and we are gathering all these metrics, diagnostics data, and we're not changing the system in any way. We are just basically monitoring what the state is all over. And this scheduled monitoring, it's kind of a flexible way of taking your infrastructure into consideration, because when we have created these monitoring packs, we cannot think of all your scenarios, how your infrastructure is built up, and we cannot just account for everything. So we kind of have the initial go, the best practice, and the multiple ways that you can hook in your requirements, your needs. And the scum pack for this scheduled monitoring is used to raise human awareness. With scheduled monitoring, I'll just get back to it in a demo in a little while. But it's something that you can configure to monitor the system. It can be configured to respond to issues, to alerts, and actually do some repairing of the system itself. And it's only when some alerts cannot be auto repaired, let's say that it needs some human attention. So it'll be alerted to SCUM, raised to SCUM, and an operations manager will go in and check what's wrong with this alert, and can actually deal with the system, restart the server or what have we. And the scheduled monitoring, it's very flexible because it's all created in PowerShell. You can do whatever you can do in PowerShell, and that's basically everything. It's up to you to actually create your monitors, to create your alerts, and use SCUM if you have that system to get awareness of all the alerts. And I'll do a little demo. Let's go to one of the machines here. Let's see. This one. This is the machine that Bass has been remoting into using PowerShell remoting, and he has been creating a bunch of server instances and a lot of tenants, and everything has been set up with users, so a lot of users can log into all these different systems. But everything, I believe actually there's only one server instance here. Everything is running in one server instance. And there are some key things that are server instance only, and that's, for instance, all the endpoints. You only have one client services port. You only have one management port. You only have one port, one endpoint for SOAP and OData as such that is open to the world. So all these ports must kind of are server instance wide in the context of the server instance, but also certificates. And if I go to the machine, well then just want to see what kinds of certificates we have here. Yeah, right here. This machine has been configured with this kind of site-aware certificate. It is self-signed, means that the certificate has been used to sign itself, and it expires in 2040. So it's very long running, and most likely it'll never expire within the lifetime of this server at least. But it's not normal when you acquire a certificate from somebody who has expertise to require or issue these certificates as certificate authority, then you most likely does not get a certificate that'll expire in 30 or 40 years. It's something you will renew every year, maybe every other year, and that's just the business model. Basically, they cannot live off issuing one certificate in the lifetime of the company. So these certificates will expire at some point, and when the server starts up, well, then it's actually monitoring the certificate itself. If I, for instance, change, I have some certificates here. I have that one that is, just valid until 2014. I have one that has expired, and one here that is close to expiration. So if I change one of these certificates, I have the certificate details here. These are the certificates. The thumbprint is what I need. I can also get the thumbprint here. If I double click, for instance, the certificate that has expired, you can see it's not valid any longer. You can go to the details. I can scroll down, find the thumbprint right here, and this is the value. But I have the list of all the certificates here, and I have the PowerShell needed to change the certificate on the server. I can also use MMC, as you can see right here. Not that one. Okay, but I can also use the NAV management console, and you can see, as you saw it before, that there's a certificate thumbprint value for the server instance. But I'll just start up using PowerShell and take this certificate here. That's the close to expiration. And start up PowerShell. Run as administrator. Paste the line. And it tells me to restart the server instance in order for this to take effect. Have server instance 01, restart. And it's actually shutting down all of the tenants running or hosted by this server instance and starting them again. Now everything is running, I can go to the event log and refresh it. And you'll be able to see that, okay, we are listening on the different ports. We have the server, that's normal services endpoint for web server, and we have one here for the client services, and we have one for the management service. That's our PowerShell endpoint, and then we have one for OData. That's the four endpoints we have. And then we have some warnings here. That's something with SPN, hasn't been configured in this environment here. Don't have permissions for it. And then we have some other information. I have some warnings here, and that is a warning around certificate. So the server itself is monitoring certificates. So it's actually saying, well, this certificate that is used by this server is close to its expiration date, says here. So the server knows that the certificate is about to expire, and there's a unique information here. You can see there's a unique event ID, and what you can do, well, you can shift to SCUM. Hopefully SCUM will detect that there's something wrong. I'll just go there. Here we go. And you can see there's a warning on one of the server instances. If I double click that one, you can see, oh, it has actually detected that there's an issue with one of the certificates on one of the server instances on one of my machines. Of course, I can also just, if I don't have Operations Manager, I can go and occasionally read the event log on all these different machines. Just log in, read the event log, log out. Log in, read the event log, log out. But that's very time consuming. But for very simple cases like this, then you might be able to set up some rules saying, okay, I want this task to be performed whenever I get this sort of event. And I can go back to my machine here. This guy, and say, okay, I want stuff to happen here whenever I see this event in the event log. And I can go to take the task scheduler, a built-in feature of Windows. So I can say, whenever I see this event, something should happen. It's coming from the application, from this event source, has this event ID. Go next, action, start a program. I can send an email, display a message. Of course, I can send an email to somebody or display a message or send an SMS or something in the middle of the night, but maybe the machine can auto-resolve this issue. Run a program, yeah. It could be a PowerShell script. Let's see if I have one here available. Otherwise, I will create one, very simple. I basically just say for this simple example, I will need to create a new certificate or enroll a new certificate that is still valid. Already have one on my system. So I will just take the valid certificate here and copy. And I will Notepad. I need to change the certificate to this one. I know for sure that I'll also have to restart the server. Instance 01, reset, restart. Just have to consult PowerShell here. It says restart. That should do. And then this one should be running in the context where all our commandlets has been loaded. So I need to add them. So this little script will change the certificate, restart the server, and it should be operational again. So I can just save this little script here. Save. Put it in the root, just for convenience. Change third PS1. There we go. And back to task scheduler. See if I. Yeah. So I'll run a program. That's PowerShell. And I will call an argument at PS1. Yeah. Should be fine. I need to open the dialog here because I need to ensure that this one is running with the highest privilege. You need to be a local administrator to run the PowerShell API. So that's the only change I need. Of course, I can do a lot of other stuff here, like changing the server it's running on 2012. I can do that. I don't have to. I mean, it's very simple. I can say this is a trigger. It runs every time I receive this type of event log entry. I can do some actions. I can do a lot of actions. I can say whenever it's supposed to run, I can set the settings. What happens? Should it retry if it fails? Should it stop if it has been running for 3 days? And so forth. It's a lot of information I can set. But basically, I just want to have this schedule, this little program being run whenever an event is triggered in the event log with the correct ID. So, code has been created. So if I restart the server once more, then you can see, oh, it's actually calling into a new PowerShell script that is changing something. Basically, it's changing the certificate thumbprint, restarting the server, and it should be operational now. And if I go to the event log again and refresh it, then I hopefully will see that the certificate is valid with no warnings. And I can see here, oh, there we go. Double click, sorry. That we have a certificate, and that one is, yeah, it's valid. So it's saying that the server is monitoring, or the service is monitoring certificate expiration, but there's nothing wrong, and it gives me the information here. So I mean, this little script, or this little sample about scheduled monitoring is auto-repairing the system. And if I go to Operations Manager, then hopefully it has picked it up already. There we are. Yeah, you can see it's healthy. Haven't done anything. So server is back in operational state. Everything is healthy, and it's actually very nice. I can extend it, of course. If I go to this guy again, I have some scripts here in a little folder called Scheduled Monitoring. I can just show you them. There's one testing the tenant databases. Edit. And this little script, well, basically the first thing it does is it's adding our snap in, our commandlets. That's the first line here. And then it's iterating through all the NAV server instances running on this machine that has the state of running. And it's iterating through all of them and getting all the tenants for all the server instances. And then it's calling another of our commandlets, saying invoke code unit. And it's invoking the code unit on server instance for a given tenant, and it's invoking code unit 1. And with no other parameters specified, then it's invoking the onRun method on code unit 1. That one always exists, and in the default database, the demo database, it doesn't contain any code as such. So it's basically just pinging the tenant database and see if it can communicate. You can think of it as a synthetic transaction. It's actually doing stuff, but in this case, it's just a heartbeat to the tenant databases. So it's doing that for all of the tenant databases and returning something for the task scheduler. Oh, there's an exit one, there's an error code you need to respond to. So you can retry and retry. And what we have done for tenant monitoring is basically just an event monitor. So we are monitoring all events that are generated for a specific tenant. And if you have 3 of those errors or warnings within 5 minutes, then it changes the state of the tenant to yellow. So there's a warning. It doesn't necessarily mean that the function or the system or the tenant is not operational, but there's definitely something that you will have to look into. Go to the event log and see what's wrong here. This is fortunate because you're actually invoking something on a tenant, and there's built-in support in the runtime, in the server, so it can generate a tenant-specific event log information by executing this one. If you don't have that scenario, I mean, all infrastructure deployments are different, so you won't necessarily have the support from the server, then you can kind of cheat. I have another one here. Edit. And what it does, well, it's loading our commandlets. And then I have a little function here that is basically just calling into an executable called netstat. That is an all Windows operating system. It returns the status of all the TCP and UDP ports on the system. So you can see, oh, if the port available, is it listening, or is it not available, basically. And I'm doing the same. Oh, whoops. Magic here, where I'm iterating through all the server instances and looking for all configurations where I filter for the ports. So everything, either the management services port, the client services port, the OData or SOAP services port, all these ports should be operational. So the server should be listening on those ports in this little sample. And if it's not, well, then I'm creating an event log entry here. So I'm just creating one, the application, giving it the server instance name, saying it's an error, and writing a little message here saying, oh, this server instance is not listening to this port, basically. So it has the state of something returned. And then I give it an event ID. I mean, I can choose to create a operations monitor rule that reacts on that specific event ID 911. I can do whatever magic I need. So it's up to you to kind of create the little scripts, do the scheduled monitoring, and then if you have SCUM, you can monitor those. So I will start this one up. I will go to task scheduler. I will import a task. Right here. TCP port state. Run with highest privilege. That's fine. Start the little script here. Just execute. Specified account name is not valid. Go back and see, oh, it has been created on a different machine. So the NAV user here is a local administrator. So that's fine. Okay, I'll run it. It's disabled. I will enable it. So, and you can see the state right now. It has been configured to run every minute. It hasn't run before, but I can just initially start it up and say, oh, it has been running successfully, and it'll run the next time in very short time. And now it's in a minute. So from now on, it's every minute. And it'll actually produce some information in the event log. Well, currently everything is running fine. These are not the events I'm producing, but if I go to the management console, I can pick the instance, edit, and go in and disable the SOAP endpoint, save, it's fine, restart the server. Oh, yes please. And I will go back to this one, just run it once manually so you can see that it should be generating warnings now. Go to the event log. Yeah, or an error, actually. Set it to an error. So it says server instance 01, SOAP services port equals 2012, health state, and there's nothing. I mean, I just created this error message, so it could be very descriptive if I choose to. And now the default rule of SCUM is that, well, within 5 minutes, it'll turn the state into a warning because we have all these errors being generated. And I can do the same for tenants, but I don't think we have time to do that right now. But I will go to the SCUM server so you can see that it will turn yellow in a little while. But again, it needs three samples as it is right now. So it'll take up to 3 minutes to turn yellow. And then we can, while having this one, we can take questions, because I think it's about time, and then you can do evaluation. And put that one up, and then we can go back to the operations manager. Yeah. So any questions? And this weird syntax you are very familiar with, I guess, but compared to the alias version of PowerShell, it looks pretty nice. So can also shift to the operations manager window here. Maybe they can coexist. Yeah. So
question. Create users from the PowerShell. Can you specify that the full name and that the user has to change after the first time?
The question was if what you can specify in PowerShell when you create users, and you can basically specify all of the properties that you can see in the Windows client. So full name and license type and everything, but about the change password at NextLogIn, so then
you can specify that the user should change the password at NextLogIn, mm-hmm. which of course you should do when you use these default passwords. And in addition to that, you can also specify the profile that it is using. So you only saw the default profile now, but you can set other profiles also.
Yes, the question was about the changelog and what users have created these users using PowerShell. And, the question is difficult to answer because some of the commandlets are not requiring a user to be in NAV. And the ones around creating users and setting permissions, they're basically just requiring you to be a local administrator on the system. So if you're a local Windows administrator on the box, then you're able to create users. Whereas if you are trying to do the synthetic transactions like invoke code unit, then you will have to be an AV user.
But I don't think there's like an audit trail so that you can see afterwards who created those users. There's no such thing as an audit trail where you can see who created these users.
It doesn't activate the changelog when you create users. Does it run an insert trigger?
The question is if it runs the uninsert trigger. Yes, it does, but It doesn't make sense if the user is not created inside NAV. If, for instance, I have a user that is only meant to do PowerShell, and that is a local administrator on the box, then I can do some of the PowerShell commandlets without being a registered NAV user. So the changelog wouldn't know where to. I mean, the user is not familiar to the system, and it doesn't have to be for users and permissions and some of the others. And I think we can easily demonstrate it, but you can see in the meantime this one has turned into yellow because there are some events being generated for that machine here, and I need to of course go into all the events being collected so you can see what's going on, and I can actually see what events are causing it, and this is the one I have been creating. I can just go back to you can take other questions.
Are there any more questions? Doesn't seem like it. Is there more that you wanted to show? Or?
No, but we are. I mean, we are staying here, so you can come down and we can clarify some issues if you have some. Yeah. Thank you.